Hey, listeners. Jeff and I are out of pocket this week for some company meetings, so in lieu of a new newsy show, we're sharing the whole first episode of Jeff's new project, First Edition, right here in this feed. If you like what you hear, and we certainly think you will, the second episode is available now as well. Just search for First Edition in your podcatcher of choice, and we'll be back here in your ears next week with more news of what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading.
Just before I get started, I want to say thanks for giving this first episode a listen. I've been thinking about the show for at least 8 years, and I'm excited to get rolling. If you do want to keep up with the show on social, links to Twitter and Instagram are in the show notes, and there's also a free Substack that will have some extra stuff too. And this is the most important part. I want to hear what you think. This is going to be a work in progress. Some of this stuff will work, some of the stuff won't. But if you have an idea about who you'd like to hear from or what the show could do, please, please write to me at firstedition@bookriot.com. First Edition just spelled out like it sounds. I will write back, even if it's just to say thanks. And if you do like the show, tell someone about it. And if you don't know anyone who might like it, or even if you do, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Okay, I think that's it for now. Let's go. In this inaugural edition of First Edition, my longtime podcast running buddy, Rebecca Shinsky, joins me to try to pick the it book of April. Sarah Bakewell comes on to talk about her new book on humanism. It's called Humanly Possible. And Simon & Schuster senior editor Yadan Israel comes by to discuss how hard it is to put books in the world, why to do it, and the book business in general. Hope you'll stick around for that. Let's get into it. All right. It makes sense that Rebecca Shinsky, my longtime podcasting running buddy, kicks off the first segment of the first episode of this First Edition podcast for a couple of reasons. One is you and I have tried to talk about new books in different ways for what, 10 years, Rebecca? We've been trying to figure out how to do this for 10 years. And you yes. know as well as I do, and as well as anyone does, let's just call it what it is, the impossibility of doing the segment what we're about to do, which I'll get to right now. We're going to try to pick the it book of the month. And we're going to do that for a couple of reasons. One, it's fun. Two, it's hard. And three, we're interested in it. So that's kind of where we are here. And here's the reason it's hard. If you're a book person, if you're listening to this, you know how impossible covering books. There's too many books. There's so many books
yes.
and so many genres. And we don't get that much information. It's so fragmented that it's extremely, extremely hard to cover. And the only thing I don't understand is how to do this. So the only way I know how to do it is try, right? So the gimmick I came up with, Rebecca, you and I have been trying to come up with gimmicks, and this is the most recent gimmick. And sometimes we find ones we like and sometimes we don't. And we'll see how this goes. We haven't done this before. Is I have gone and picked 10 books being published in April that I think are contenders to be the it book of the month for various reasons, which I'll get into the criteria I think we both have in our mind. And then we're going to go down the list, and it's a knockout round. So the first one is the winner by default. And then this, we'll talk about that for a couple minutes. And then I'll present the second book in the list. We'll say, okay, kind of like a March Madness style where there's only one winner per round. And by the end, whatever book wins the last matchup, we say that's the it book of the month. Now, the question you should be asking if you're listening, what does it book means? I don't know, except that I feel like I know at the same time. So tell me, Rebecca, if this makes sense to you. It is some alchemy of if the book is good, caveat, caveat, if it has some juice in the industry, right? Publishers, writers, editors, whatever, think it's interesting. Three, it sells, right? It has to have some, yes. it has to have some element of sales. And then sort of four, it feels like it's something that may endure. It may exceed the kind of moment. And you throw those things into the pot and you kind of see. Now, if something is going to be the bestseller by a wide margin, it might not be enough because that could be just a run-of-the-mill John Grisham book, right? It can't just be that.
Correct.
It also can't just be all the literary hipsters are into it. Now, maybe there's a situation where it's such a big deal, like the one I'm thinking about is Spare, the Prince Harry book. Mm-hmm. Not a book you and I care about. It sold a bunch of copies. I don't know if it's going to do or not. I don't even know if it's good, but it kind of didn't matter. The zeitgeistiness and the sales were just enough to blow out of the category. So Rebecca,
right.
is my head screwed on at least not incorrectly about how we're doing this or how we should think about this?
Yeah, I think that's mostly right. And mostly right is about as right as you can get when you're trying to capture something like this that is kind of ineffable. That you could have a book that's really big on one or two of those elements that you were describing. And as you were saying with Spare, like it wouldn't matter that it didn't have a third or a fourth of the elements. You can have some books that ring all four of those bells and still don't feel like the it book. And so there's also just this, you know it when you see it thing that is frustrating because it is impossible to explain and it's impossible to predict. But we do see this in the industry. You know when a book has become the it book. We also know when we're seeing publishers try to position a book as an it book,
That's
but
true.
that's really difficult
Very
and
hard
very
to do.
rarely successful. So I think this is a good framework to start in, and I like this knockout round flavor. We haven't tried this before. I'll say I have done no homework as requested for this.
Yes, thank
So
you
the
very much.
only April titles that are even kind of floating around in my mind are the ones that I had earmarked for myself to take a look at coming out next month. There's a handful of those, but I didn't revisit my long list from the spring books draft that we did over on the Book Riot podcast Patreon. I'm trying to come in fresh. So I'm really looking forward to the surprise of what you've picked here. And I think April is an interesting month because from my recollection, there aren't a lot of like big shiny titles. There's not like a Tuesday in April where 19 things are coming out that are all going to be competing against each other. So finding it is maybe this is even harder this month than it would be in most months.
I think it's harder, but it's kind of fractal, right? It's a smaller, harder problem that will have a bigger, harder problem time within May. Because I was looking at May and there's a bunch. Is it harder where there's a bunch of contenders or fewer contenders? I don't know the answer to that. I
Yeah,
think we'll
I
kind
got
of
to
find
tell
out.
you, I am already dreading being here to do October.
Yeah, that's going to be
So
150 titles. I didn't tell you this, but we're going to do 150 title knockout round for
it's a
October.
week-long episode of First
Yeah,
Edition.
right.
Just
We're going to
stay
live
with
stream it
us.
for charity for 24 hours. It's going to be a marathon.
Great.
So I picked 10 titles and I kind of used my own filter. And some of these I don't think are really contenders. I think are worth talking about or have like one of the quadrants they're
Okay.
especially strong in. But then I random.org them. So I didn't put them in any strategic
Love it.
pattern. If I had done the pattern for drama purposes, I would have done something else. But I tried to make that a part of it. Okay, let's get to book number one. Wonder Boy. This is a book about Tony Hsieh, the co-founder of Zappos, and who was one of the. You're going to read a profile about what's right with tech in Silicon Valley. They're going to mention Tony Hsieh. If you know the story at all, it does not end well for Tony Hsieh. And it's a very human, it's a very messy, very compelling cautionary tale character study. The authors of this are Angel Alwyn and David Jeans. Both of them are investigative reporters in the business world, one for the Wall Street Journal and one for Forbes. I'm guessing if I had to guess which one might have been on your list, I would guess you had Wonder Boy circled. What about
Yes.
this book as a contender for the It Book? Strengths and weaknesses, Rebecca.
Well, strengths are there is something to talk about. You can imagine like the Today Show segment about it. There's a way to spin this towards sort of the mainstream reader of like the untold story or like the seedy underbelly of what happened at this company that you like, you're right, you can't read a business book with modern profiles and not hear a story about Zappos. Nonfiction, unless it's self-help, is a tough sell for an it book. So that goes against it. But this might snag that like that sort of business. It might be sticky enough that the business reader of airport books could do some stuff with this.
You've
I
got to
don't
have
know.
some bad blood in you. And I think that's what I
You
was thinking
do.
about here is that there is a juicy story here, and it's a dark one. My other thought here is about this exercise in this book in general is we may not know for 6 months what was the it book of the month, because if this gets announced 2 months after as being an Apple TV Plus series, right,
Correct.
with, Henry Golding or someone playing Tony Hsieh, then the future of this gets really elevated
I
at
know.
some
I
point.
really wonder if the authors of this book are sad that they didn't publish it 2 years ago so that they could have been in last summer's run with the shows about WeWork and Uber and about Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes. But I mean, there's a lot of interest in that. So I think it's possible, maybe not the, if I were looking at a list of books of April, probably not the one I would have put at the top of the list. So I'm maybe skeptical that this is going to come out on top at the end of our round, but definitely one to have an eye on.
And I think both you and I will be reading this for for what it's worth. Yeah. This is, if I'm doing my own power ranking, this is way towards the top. Mm-hmm. Number two, I put on here, I've read half of this book. I'm in the middle of it. That's something I should say. A couple of these I've read. I'm reading a little bit more into the front list or yet to be released. Okay. So debut novels, you shouldn't include them, Rebecca, in this.
Right. You should not.
Because to the first order of a first approximation, zero of them will matter, right? Debut mm-hmm. authors are hard. Fiction is hard in general. So having said that, maybe you want to take a flyer on a long odds one. So that's one that's here. I think the pitch is really interesting. And then I really like the half of the book that I've read so far. So having said all that, the book is Camp Zero. It's a debut novel by Michelle Minn Sterling. And the comps here are Station 11 and The Power. So Station 11, of course, is Emily St. John Mandel's book, and then the TV show. And The Power is Naomi Alderman's, you know, spec fic book about women in power.
And there's a show about that coming out.
Show about
soon
that coming out too. So this one is something very bad has happened. The main character, the point of view character you start out with at least, is coming to this camp far in the north of Canada. There's been some sort of climate apocalypse. I don't know if it's an accrual apocalypse, like the one we get in the Wall Street Journal every day. It's like, if you don't throw away your plastic cups by 2038, you know, all the zebras are going to burst into flames. I don't know if it's that, or there's been a meteor or a volcano or whatever, but it doesn't matter. You go up to Canada because it's still habitable there. And the main character is a sex worker that's sort of brought in to go to this camp. But there's more to her story. I think it's really interesting. I think it'd have some crossover appeal. The problem is it's a debut novel. If this was someone's second novel that had a little bit of juice, I'd be higher on it maybe even would be my number two or three draft pick. But I think it's the kind of book, it got a Publisher's Weekly starred review. They're putting some money behind it. So you haven't read this book. From a pitch, zeitgeisty point of view, that's what we're going here with, going pitch, zeitgeisty, and it's also upmarket literary spec fic, which is in the pocket, right, for at the basically pinnacle of literary culture right now.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
So your question is, does it drop, does it punch, all you have to decide right now, does it knock off Wonder Boy? That's all you have to decide, but
I'm
give
pondering.
Some feedback on the book itself.
I think I'm sticking with Wonder Boy here. Debut fiction is really hard.
Yeah.
When you're publishing debut fiction with sticky current topics like this, the zeitgeisty stuff that you were talking about, what you're really hoping for is the book club crowd. And to hit the book club crowd, the book cannot be too edgy, like just edgy enough, just pushing current events enough. I'm concerned about, I mean, me personally.
Dystopian
not,
sex workers? You're not saying that's the meat and potatoes of the book club crowd, Rebecca?
I think that dystopian sex worker is a tough sell for probably a good third of the Reese Witherspoon book club crowd. They're going to skip that one. And so that's why I'm going to stick with Tony Hsieh.
Okay. I think that's fair. I'm glad to talk about it. Also, if it wins the National Book Award or it's a Penn Faulkner finalist and sells a bunch, maybe we don't know. Maybe.
And
could do.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of it before, so this one's going on my list. So this, you know, 10 minutes here has already been worth it for me.
That's April 4th, I should say. And then Wonder Boy is April 25th. I guess that's a nice transition to my third contender. Romantic comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld, who I think sits comfortably at the center of commercial fiction at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The pitch here, Curtin Sedefeld has written, I'll prep. Is that her best known book? Am I thinking about
it?
I don't have it in front of me. She also wrote This American Wife, Sisterland, Eligible. You know, the most recent one was The Rodham, this literary imagining of Hillary Rodham Clinton as a young woman. So this is called Romantic Comedy. In the pitch here, it's set in it's a novel, set in the world of a Saturday Night Live-like show, which I think is fun. I think that's a fun idea. I've liked almost everything I've seen is set in Saturday Night Live, like Milou's like 30 Rock or Studio 60, various successes. And I know it's going to be a shock to you that two of the writers have a thing, or maybe have a thing, and then one of them gets into a relationship with one of the guest hosts, who tend to be much more famous people in a Saturday Night Live world, and then someone writes a sketch about that relationship for the show, which is a juicy moment, I think.
Spicy.
Yeah. It instead of saving it for the group text, they saved it for the group sketch, I guess, in this particular.
For the whole world.
For the whole world, and it gets messy, but it is a romance, right? Romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. So you kind of know where it's going to go. Curtin Sittenfeld, that's called romantic comedy. Rebecca, will this knock off Wonder Boy to be our number one contender for It Book of the Month?
I think it will.
Yeah.
I have read some middling reviews of it. I don't think that matters. It says what it is on the box.
Yep.
It's a romantic comedy. Sittenfeld writes a good, like, beach reedy, page turner kind of situation. Like, you're not going into a Curtis Sittenfeld novel because you're looking for high literary art.
No.
These are like quality, upper middle brow. I think that's fine and good. And she's very good at it. And like, I was the one kind of, I was skeptical when Emily Henry first came out and I was like, they're seriously just calling this book beach read. But that seems to be a very successful strategy.
Yep.
So calling a romance, romantic comedy, I think it's very smart. It seems to be of the moment. And I love the vibe, like the summer camp vibe of a mm-hmm. workplace like SNL, where everybody's all in each other's business. I think that's a lot of fun. I am already more interested in watching the adaptation of this than reading the book.
Sketch comedy on the page is super hard.
Right. It is.
You can see that being performed in a slightly different way. Anytime you're writing a book where there's another art form in it, that means you have to write a good book and a good version of that other art mm-hmm. form, right? Like we talked about this in when we talked about Tomorrow, not only have to write
Daisy
a good
Jones.
Novel, you have to write a good video game or a good song or a good poem or anything else like that. Very difficult. I think that's right. I agree with you that right now, Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld is the champ. All right, next. I'm going a little bit more. I picked this for this reason, but it came up in the random order. Just here is what it is. Let's go. Mm-hmm. Let's go. What about the sentence? The quality of the line? Can it be mm-hmm. enough? You and I both like memoirs by poets. Not Ooh. Typically a great seller, but they can be a mover. They can stick around. And You Could Make This Place Beautiful, a memoir by Maggie Smith, is going to be a book that's in a lot of literary tote bags on the F train in Brooklyn this summer. Is it going to sell enough? Is it going to be good enough? You know, sometimes you get a Terry Tempest Williams. Sometimes you get a magical thing. My Year of, God darn it, what's the Joan Didion?
The Year of Magical Thinking.
You get these from time to time, and these are a slow comer. So if this happens, it will not sell very much, but then get picked up. It'll be number 10, 11 on the hardback nonfiction bestseller list for like 30 weeks, and then goes into the fall and it becomes a book you get for Christmas or something else like that. That's my case for this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't pretend it's going to sell more than romantic comedy, but it's enough of the other things, I guess, to be our number one contender for April's It Book of the Month.
Yeah, I'm going to let this knock out romantic comedy.
Wow, tell me about that. An upset, I think.
If there is a poet memoir that could knock out something that's like bubblegummy and fun, like Curtis Sittenfeld, I think it's this. And it's because she has that one poem, Good Bones,
yeah.
that literally everyone and their mother has posted on Facebook at some point. And if they are marketing the book in that way to reach that audience, I know I've seen the cover of this and it's yep. floral. And I'm pretty sure it even says like author of Good Bones.
I didn't see that. I'm looking in Edelweiss okay. right now. It doesn't have that,
okay.
but they should put that on
right.
there. You absolutely
they
should
yes. or like connect it. Maybe it'll be connected to the marketing mm-hmm. somehow. Also, this is coming out right when people need to buy books
That's
for Mother's
point.
Day.
It's a wonderful thing.
And I think that could give it a bump in sales for late April, early May, as folks are doing that. This is a Mother's Day, spring mom birthday situation, might have a long tail on it. Yeah, if anybody's going to knock out something popcorny, it's going to be Maggie Smith. So a little bit of an upset, but I am going to stand by it.
I think it's telling that it made the most anticipated books of 2020 list of these publications. Book Page, which is a industry rag, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Newsweek, can't get any more mainstream than that.
Nope.
Good Housekeeping, that's book
there
clubs and moms.
There it is.
And Lit Hub, mm-hmm. which is the elevated, right? That's the snob taste. You know, we like Lit Hub. I'm not saying that, but I read Lit Hub. I am a Lit Hub reader, both metaphorically
and
actually.
They know what they're about.
They know what they're about. And then Zibby, which yep. is, mm-hmm. you know, this is a place that's about kind of this space. So I think, I don't know that I would have come up with myself, but the Mother's Day thing you said, and the ubiquity, the virality of that single poem gives her enough name recognition that
and
it helps.
Isn't the title, You Could Make This Place Beautiful from Good Bones? I think there's some connection.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I didn't get that deep into the weeds on it.
Okay.
there's no transition to Small Mercies by Dennis Lehane. Dennis Lehane returns.
Wow, that is a hard right turn. You're right.
The random.org has no mercy for me. This coming out from Harper, April 25th as well. Dennis Lehane, you and I are not connoisseurs of the crime novel, but we know enough to know that Lehane is one of the leading lights. So his best known
I'm
book.
I'm a half connoisseur of the movie based on a Lehane.
There you go. Yeah. Mystic River, right? Sean Penn really going full Sean Penn in that scene. Everybody knows. It sounds like hard to know in pre-publication blurbage and talking about these books, but it sounds like this is a excellent version of Lehane. It also has a wrinkle. It feels like he's dealing with race in a way, trying to incorporate race, which I don't think he's really done before.
Interesting.
There's a couple of deaths. One is a white person and one is a black person, and they seem unrelated. But I don't think this is a spoiler when it sounds like turns out they are going to be related. No mystery or thriller has ever had two unrelated deaths in the first 20 pages. That's not how these things go. There is a really, really good blurb from Gillian Flynn. This is a whole nother episode of what blurbs we pay attention to. I do pay attention to Gillian Flynn. It's not even her imprint. It's not her publisher. So this comes out April 70s crime books, kind of a hard ask, but right now, I think of the people we've talked about so far, if we're talking 20, 30 years from now, are people going to know the name Lehane in his space? I think probably right now we've got this is the name brand. This is a series. People know what you're going to get. On the other hand, people know what you're going to get. So it's hard to get excited about and find a bunch of new readers for Small Mercies by Dennis Lehane.
I think I'm sticking with Maggie Smith here. Dennis Lehane is almost definitely going to beat her in sales. But in terms of like longevity, people talking about it with each other, something in the zeitgeist, I think that the Smith has a greater chance.
Okay. I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's fair. Next up, David Gran's The Wager, coming out April 18th. David Gran, I guess zeitgeist is a good word because we've had the gathering storm clouds, and I'm looking at the cover of The Wager, which is about a shipwreck and mutiny and murder, so this is not a random metaphor. The storm clouds of Killers of the Flower Moon, both as a text itself, that book is really good, and it's become a staple of the narrative nonfiction genre, and one of the probably best examples of it, frankly, a popular narrative nonfiction, Killers of the Flower Moon. And we've got Marty Scorsese and DiCaprio, who've been doing sort of pub on Gran's behalf for like 3 years while they're making this movie. Yeah.
3 years for a 3.5-hour movie.
Yeah.
This one's tough. I think David Gran is going to knock out Maggie Smith.
I think so too.
It's just big news that there is a new David Gran. He has enough name recognition among folks who read that kind of narrative nonfiction. He gets in there in a way that few writers do. It's just really absorbing reading. And Father's Day is also
Father's
coming
Day
up. This
coming
is dad
up.
Book.
Tall Ships. Just, this is literally Tall Ships.
It is. It's perfect. Listeners of the BR pod will know that my Bob has had this pre-ordered.
I was going to say, did he get it tattooed on his body?
there's still time for that. Yeah. We'll see.
Can we talk about Gran's hit rate for a minute? I'm just looking at his backlist. We've got Killers of the Flower Moon 2017. Lost City of Z. Ever heard of it?
Yep.
Unbelievable. Yep. The Devil and Sherlock Holmes, The White Darkness, and The Splendid and the Vile. That's an unbelievable run. Not one of those is bad. Not one of those is even B+. Those are A narrative nonfiction, popular narrative nonfictions. I think he's the king of this. I think he's the king of the accessible narrative nonfiction. I think it's him now.
Yeah, it's David Gran and our good friend, the Moneyball guy.
Oh, Michael Lewis. Yeah.
Michael Lewis. I was like, Michael Smith. Yeah, it's David Gran and Michael Lewis. Different flavors.
Yeah, different flavors. Yeah. So, okay, I would agree with you that The Wager knocks out.
Okay. All right.
Small Mercies. The next one, you mentioned her name before. It's Happy Place by Emily Henry, coming out in October.
Wait, coming out in October?
No, April. I just had a brain fart about that. Coming out in April. It's an Emily Henry book. A couple who broke up months ago make a pact to pretend to still be together for their annual week-long vacation with their best friends in this glittering and wise, I'm reading the blurb, It looks like a Emily Henry book. Mm-hmm. It walks like a Emily Henry book. It's going to sell like an Emily Henry book. And I think you can hear in both of our voices even now that that feels to us like both a strength for this book's contention and a weakness for this book's contention.
Yeah. This one got a starred review in Publishers Weekly, yeah, which is interesting. TikTok is still a thing. Presumably it'll still be a thing in like 3 weeks when this book comes out. And Emily Henry's got a lot of juice there. David Grand is David Grand, but ain't nobody competing with TikTok juice right now. So I think
you think it's going to outsell the wager.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And she's just got such an accumulated fandom. David Grand is who I'm putting my money on for the long run. We're more likely to be talking about David Grand in 5 or 10 years because we've been talking about David Grand for 5 or 10 years. But I think Emily Henry in short term, folks are going to talk about it. It's going to go all over social media. She will get the book club readers. This thing where romance is going mainstream is very cool, and I'm super into it. The mainstreaming of romance and sort of removing all of the like taboo or stigma around that corner of genre fiction is a real service to readers. I feel very torn about this, but I think it's Emily Henry.
Can I try to turn you around on it knocking out the wager real quick? Here's the thing. The Emily Henry book is going to sell, and it's going to sell very well into the summer. And then in 6 months, there's going to be another Emily Henry book that looks like it. Or there's going to be other romance TikTok books in this commercial romance space.
And the wager is going to be on end of year lists and gift guides. Yes.
And the Killers of the Flower Moon is going to come out. Mm-hmm. And David Grand's going to be on Front Street doing that.
Nominations for things. Yes. Okay, yeah. Let's stick with the wager. That'll make my heart happy.
Yeah, okay. No shots at Happy Place. But like one of the things the romance writers do so well is they write a lot of these. Grand writes a book every 4 years.
And that's true. It's more of an event.
So there we go. All right, next up.
All right.
T.J. Klun occupies a very unusual spot in the books and reading lineup. And I don't know what to do with it because we talked about this when we were doing a seasonal draft earlier about how The House in the Cerulean Sea is one of the recent phenomenons. And he's carved out a space for himself that is like commercially popular spec fic, right? And The Lives of Puppets sounds even weirder than Under the Whispering Door, House on Cerulean Sea, to the point where it's about puppets living in trees, and it's sort of based on Pinocchio and Swiss Family Robinson and WALL-E. I really like this idea. I'm going to read this book. This will be my first Klun. I've been circling Cerulean Sea forever, but in the terms of keeping up with the discourse no one cares about really in the world of books, I want to sort of be on this. It has a 400,000 print run, which is huge for a book like
this.
That
is huge.
I don't know what to do with this. The only thing I knew was to put on the list and talk to you about it for a few minutes.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The smartest bet for anything like this is to think it will come out of the gate on that huge print run and then, you know, we'll see recession to the mean.
Yeah.
And it's really difficult to repeat big surprise success like House in the Cerulean Sea was. Mm-hmm. For what it's worth, that's the one that the more civilian readers in my life are just
exactly
now discovering.
That's right. Yeah. The late adopters.
I'm just starting to get texts from the people who like books but don't pay attention to them professionally about, have you heard of this Cerulean Sea book? So I'm going to stick with the wager here. I think that T.J. Klun will come out of the gate with meaningful sales and his fans will be very excited. This sounds like a tougher sell for someone who hasn't already read him. So those folks who are on the long tail and are just discovering House in the Cerulean Sea, maybe they'll be open to T.J. Klun in general after that. But if you aren't familiar with him, this is a pretty weird pitch to start with. So I'm sticking with David Grin.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's fair. Next up is Living Remedy by Nicole Chung. Memoir. Nicole Chung has carved out a spot for herself as a sensitive, erudite memoirist of her own experience, but then also her own experience can be bridged into larger things. Basically trying to understand the lives of her parents. She is a adoptee. And her parents are white, and she grew up in a very white Oregon hometown and basically was upwardly mobile, but also some stuff happened. she's going to be one of these people, it sounds like, who's going to write memoirs of different stages of her life. And I'm looking forward to every stage we've talked, you and I have talked about this privately before. She has quite a following in the literary memoir world, hasn't quite broken out. She sold very well. She's moved up in terms of the prestige and sort of the profile of the imprint she's working with. No shots, but this is what happens sometimes. The comps are like Somebody's Daughter, The Beauty in Breaking by Michelle Harper. I think those are aspirational for this book. And so it would be a stretch for it to have the kind of sales and recognition that Somebody's Daughter get. And I don't know that that turned out to be a giant seller. I think it did pretty well. The Beauty in Breaking, I think, has had some staying power. I know that's a book you really like. So I think for the tote bag crowd, this is going to be a huge hit, and people are going to be talking, and you're going to see, if you're on Twitter and you see literary writers, they're going to be tweeting about this book more than, say, T.J. Klune or The Wager, probably. But is that enough, Rebecca, do you think, to fire shots over the bow of David Grann?
I do think so. I think this has Reese's Book Club potential written all over it. And it has the ability to get into like the broad book club crowd to talk about the kinds of issues that mainstream readers who want to be just sort of, you know, familiar with what's going on in the world, or to, you know, sound like they are, to be comfortable talking about difficult things. This is a way into those that like Camp Zero doesn't give you. It sounds like Camp Zero, just to go back to the top of the show, that like dystopian sex worker thing is a real hard pitch for some readers. I think that this is more accessible. Nicole Chung writes about challenging things, but in a pretty accessible and like non-judgmental way. Like one of the things that made Somebody's Daughter, I think, so powerful was that Ashley Ford talked about really difficult experiences, but wasn't like ragey and judgmental about her parents on the page. And that made it possible for people to engage with the story and either ask questions about their own upbringing or their own parenting. Sounds like Chung is doing something similar here. That was definitely my experience with her first book. She's both a literary darling and also really starting to gain some popularity. I think
All You Can Ever Know was a bestseller. I mean, bestseller, but I think a legitimate in its space, the kind of book that sells.
And starting to, I think she really has a shot at some end of year awards and the best of lists, like long-term sales numbers. Grann is probably going to beat her, but I think the other quadrants, this is a really strong contender. So I'm actually going to make, there's something stickier about this for the readers who buy most of the books, which is women.
That's a great point. I really like your idea, or maybe there's higher variance with Living Remedy, maybe I'd say. If it becomes an Oprah pick or a Reese pick, or it's the national, it wins the National Book Award for nonfiction, or makes the 10 best of the year, it could sell a lot more copies, right? It's a historical fiction about tall ships is the flip side of that. It's historical fiction or a historical nonfiction about tall ships.
Right. Yeah. That's like a really deep quality dad book, but you're not going to sell it to, you know, the average woman browsing the new release table at Barnes & Noble.
So that's the number nine. We've got one more pick, and it's a little bit of a bummer that it's another debut. That's just the way the cookie crumbles. I read this book. I really liked it. It's super strange. I kind of just wanted to talk about it for a minute, so this is my show. Also, A New Dazzling Essential American Voice, that blurb, 99% of the time I don't care. Fine. Okay. This is what happens. This is from George Saunders. That's the blurb, which knows from dazzling, knows from strange.
Sure does. He sure does.
He's crossing imprint too. I always look for this. This is a Flatiron title. Saunders is Random House, Double Day. It doesn't appear. He's a PRH author. So crossing going to the other side of the aisles. There's lots of aisles. It's like one of those mega churches.
Maybe they have
there's
same a lot of agent, aisles. Though. Who knows?
Monica Brashears is a Southern, a contemporary Southern Gothic novel set in Appalachia. I think it's Tennessee or Kentucky, who is living in a ramshackle house. Her mom has just died. She's working at a gas station, and someone comes along and says, have you considered doing any modeling? Which, if you know anything about anything, you should be like, run away. And that's her first thought, right?
Okay.
She's like, am I going to get human trafficked here? But she's doesn't have anywhere else to go. I don't want to say too much else about it.
What's the title?
Oh, I'm sorry. House of Cotton by Monica Brashears. Okay. House of Cotton. It's not very long, so I think you can take a gamble on it as a reader yourself. 304 pages, it reads faster than that. It's quite strange. It's quite dark. I would say some, I don't know what specific content stuff to say, but it's weird. It's weird and strange. It's Southern, it's a gothic novel, okay? That should tell you on the tin. It has a 250,000 print run, which for a debut novel is big.
That's a big deal.
So this is really, I'm looking at this as, I get long odds on this becoming a thing, but maybe if I'm going to put a chip on the roulette wheel, maybe I get slightly better odds than just the 1 out of 36 I would normally get from a literary spec fic crossover. I think the comps here are interesting. This is what they're hoping for. If it becomes Such a Fun Age, if it becomes Of Woman and Salt, if it becomes Migrations, it could be the book of the month, Rebecca. That's my case
for it. It could. I would love to see that happen. This is going near the top of my list for April, certainly. I had seen that George Saunders blurb. That's pretty good stuff. Pretty weird and pretty dark, though, is a tough sell for.
Look, it's foolish to pick it. I just wanted to put it on here and say this is the problem.
I'm super glad that you did. I'm super glad that you picked it. I would love to be surprised and see this become the It Book of April. Not to like knock any of the other titles, or especially The Living Remedy, which is going to end up being the winner of this episode, but just because a weird book that takes a flyer at some difficult material and a publisher who puts some money to print 250,000 copies behind a voice like that that's a big vote of confidence. There's probably a pretty big ad campaign coming out around that too. They spent a lot of money to print all those books. I would love to see it happen. I love to be surprised by readers in that way, but I'm going to, for the sake of winning this game, I'm going to stick with Nicole Chung, A Living Remedy, as my strongest bet for the It Book of April.
I think that's a good pick. Let's do a quick debrief. What do you think? How'd you feel about this gimmick, Rebecca? What do you think about this structure?
I really liked this. There's something about comparing the titles one to one rather than starting with a list of 10 and trying to order them. Like, I would have had to do the homework, I think, to put them in order in advance. But doing the one to one comparison of can it beat this, and, you know, whoever wins this round just continues to advance. That was really fun. I like this format.
Congratulations to Nicole Chung for winning a game that has no referees, no rules, and really no endpoint. So we don't know. I don't know how we'll know if we got this right or wrong.
When will we decide if we were right about April?
Maybe at the end of the year. It'd be interesting to go back and say, okay, what were the books of the year, and sort of place them in their month of publication and see how close we got. Your Bayesian prior for our guess here, and I think I agree with you, the wager, I think it's a 1A, 1B if we were doing it kind of like that. Yeah. I would like to have two horses. I'd like to have slips on two horses. But I think that makes sense. But here's the thing. We're going to be wrong. Something's going to come up that I didn't make my list, right? That's always a possibility. Yes. Mm-hmm. Here's another thing. If we were taking bets and you could get odds on this, you should probably take the field against any of our picks, right? This thing goes. But
yeah.
That's the way that goes. So I'd love feedback from listeners out there. A brand new email just for the show, firstedition@bookriot.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. If there's a book I missed, Rebecca and I missed, you want to take issue with something we said, or there's a bit of information you know, or just comments on the format. Is this the kind of format you'd like to see us do every month to look at the books that are coming out? Rebecca, I really appreciate your willingness to be lassoed in to something that I'm just trying. And unfortunately, your willingness to do that means that you'll be corralled increasingly and often when it comes to the show.
I haven't met a Jeff experiment yet that I didn't want to jump on board for at least one time.
That's what all the boys like to hear. Rebecca Shinsky, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Tor Books. So if you are a fan of epic fantasy, if you're a fan of Scott Lynch and or Joe Abercrombie, but you want something a little different, you want a hero who's like a bit of a mess, then The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan is for you. In it, Academy dropout slash disgraced noble heir Lacan Gordova's life is in shambles. All he's got going for him is, one, he is a card sharp of considerable skill, and two, a lot of, maybe potentially a little too much, wine. So they're, you know, those are the positives. So when the bizarre murder of his father robs him of even the off chance of redemption, Lacan decides to make amends another way. He's going to unravel the mystery behind the killing, even if it takes him to the underbelly of Sophrona, a city of danger, secrets, and merchant princes. Finding the truth is one thing. Finding the truth and staying alive is like a whole other thing. So make sure to check out The Silver Blood Promise by James Logan on sale May 7th. And thanks again to Tor Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
Coming up in the Hammer Spot, Yadan Israel, senior editor at Simon & Schuster. Yadan and I talked for almost 2 hours, and I'm trying to get it into a 30-minute segment, so I'm just taking bits and pieces. I don't release it in some other way. I have to have Yadan back. We talked about the book business, what it means to be a reader, how hard it is to get books in the world and get people to care about them. I first thought about talking to Yadan because he has this new project called the Advanced Readers Club of trying to get review copies. These are early copies, pre-publication copies of books, into the hands of different kinds of people, not necessarily working in the literary press, review establishment, publicity, whatever, sort of regular readers, but not regular readers. They're power readers, they're connectors, they're influencers, but not in a TikTok, Instagram way, though they could be, but in a community kind of a way. You'll hear us talk about the book he's launching the Advanced Readers Club with. It's called Soil by Camille T. Dungy. She's a poet. It's a memoir meditation on what it means to be a gardener, especially as a Black woman. So check that out. Again, we'll talk about it a little bit. I don't know that I actually mentioned the name because I'm cutting this together. So I wanted to make sure you knew it was Soil by Camille T. Dungy. We had a really good conversation. So yeah, here's Yadan.
I think that there's a inherent difficulty in publishing a book, right? Because it's like you're creating something that no one knows about and you're trying to put it on people's radar in a finite amount of time. I think that a lot of how publishing functions as a framework, right? And I say this, everything I say here, I'm going to be like really like what litigious almost about this is like, this reflects my genuine opinion.
Yeah.
Israel, not a reflection of Simon & Schuster, the company or the imprint or anything at large. Publishing, I think that there is a theory about, a lot of this is largely about culture theory and about what you believe and how you believe culture moves. And there's this sort of, it's almost like a Reaganomics, like trickle down theory of like, well, if we give it to the top people in society, it'll trickle down to other people. And one of the things that I am a proponent, I am, you know, being a child of the internet, I'm a child of data. There's so much consumer data about consumer habits, about how people buy books. There was one report that showed like the top 10 reasons why people buy books, like the average everyday person buy books. number one was known author. Number two was close friend. Mm-hmm. I personally did not pay attention to 3, 4, 5, and 6 because I only care about the top two. New York Times reported 2020 being the best year for publishing, particularly like physical publishing in the history of books. And in that year, the two categories of books that performed the highest were books that were by known authors and backlist titles, right? And for people who don't know, a backlist title is a book that is a year removed from publication. The books that did the best were either known authors or backlist, which means it's like either this is somebody we already know, or this is a book that had been talked about and people have known about for years and they just never got to. Even in the year where publishing did its best, 96 to 98% of the authors who were debut authors sold less than 5,000 copies, right? That is not a defect of publishing. That is the feature. And so, and I'm asking somebody, the average person who spots four books, to either buy five or to make one of the books that which I'm responsible for bringing into the world part of that four. Those very real, like almost uncomfortable stakes that like we are doing something that doesn't need to be done and yet we care about it. And we have to now communicate to people that while you do not need this thing, we still hope that you would invest your time and your money into it.
You're thinking in terms of respect for that person's life, right? That you're trying to sell into their life, right? Because part of it is money, and that's a huge part of it. But also, it's time. If I'm going to buy the book, that's one thing. But if I'm going to sit down and read it, that's a completely other thing at the same time.
Seven to 10 hours. That's a double investment.
Yeah. And when you're bringing in the idea of data that's not getting looked at, you're looking at like the top reasons people read a particular kind of book or choose a book. You're saying there's kind of an inefficiency here in this whole way we've done this.
Well, let me be clear. It's not the top reason people read a book. It's the top reason why people buy a book, right?
Because that's never going to have, right? How many pages?
You will never, unless you make people do book reports on every book they read, there is no real way to know if someone's read a book from beginning to end.
Yeah.
Unless you're quizzing them.
Or to the half, or they picked it, did they even get it to 10, page 10? Did they do it at all?
Fair enough, right? Yeah. So like, there's no sort of way to capture that. There's no qualitative study about that besides like a test. So then I find myself at a conundrum of like, all right, so what matters to me as an editor? Does it matter that a book that I am working in conjunction with the publisher and the writer to bring into the world, does it matter if the New York Times, if it gets all this critical acclaim and yet it sells, you know, less than 10,000 copies?
Doesn't help that author have a career, doesn't become a thing in the world that people care about at all.
Right. Or is it then my position is like, you know, I take a firm stance is like, you know, I can accept, I would love a New York Times book review. I would love a LA review. I would love all those things, but it's like, why am I here? Because as an editor, I have to make my case to other people in editorial, my boss, the publisher, the publicity team, the marketing team. And then the publicity team has to make their case to the editors who want to review books. And the marketing team has to make their case to like the people who buy books. And the sales team has to make their, you know, case to the booksellers. And we're all making our case to someone else who is hopes will make their case to the end user. And I'm like, that kind of function can cause a kind of conflation of almost like a crisis of identity where we conflate the people we sell to as the end user and they're not, right? So like New York Times is not the end user for any of the books that we publish. A bookseller is not even the end user. They are a intermediary that helps us theoretically get to that reader who only becomes a reader after they bought the book. And so like by like kind of breaking down the business of it is like, okay, there's a lot of work to be done to remind myself of who actually represents, like who is the market. I think about, well, how much work and labor is actually being cultivated and really understanding the book buying market. For example, statistically, this is like public data. Black women with college degrees between the ages of 25 and 40 or something like that are, statistically speaking, the highest, the most book buying demographic across the country. College educated Black women who make above 70,000 buy the most books, right? That's data. Like, that's like to the point where it's like, that's a fact.
Yeah.
And yet you still have publishers who are not pivoting towards that demographic. That's a sales point.
Yeah.
Right. So it shows that there is still a lot of work that needs to be done about how even larger publishers reconcile data into their publishing practices, into their acquisition practices, into their marketing practices. So then what are we doing? Right. Like, are we publishing books? Are we allowing the notion that because 80% of, we know that as a publishing industry, 80% of the books will fail, we're more or less accepting any failure as being a feature of the industry?
What's so amazing to me is that when a book does break out, it has a cultural weight that no one could stop. Like, you know, if it becomes part of the culture, if it becomes part of the now or the forever, good luck stopping it. Like,
right.
By the same token, it's hard to get going. Once it gets going, it's hard to stop.
Well, okay. So I like what you're saying. Here's how I would add to what you're saying. Books, when I talk about luxury, I'm talking about time. When I'm talking about time, I'm talking about forever. And that's such a, in a lot of ways, a very intimidating premise for which to create from. Because from that standpoint, it goes, well, why create anything? It's like, yes. But if you still feel the necessity to create with those terms, then you got something worth creating. That's what I believe. Like, this is then worth the paper is printed on. This is worth that space that it has to fight for in someone's house. And if I can't justify that, this ain't the book. I would rather just buy the book when it comes out.
Well, it makes sense then when you think of the stakes being that high, then to think about what isn't being done that could help that book become a thing, that could help it find.
There you go. There you go. Right. Like, and that's why the Advanced Reader Club exists. It's like, these are resources. These advanced reader copies exist. They typically go to the same people.
Same people.
Right.
And get the same results, the same 80-20 failure.
And it's like, and then so many of them ended up getting put in an incinerator or like turned into, and it's just like, yo, like, if we going to make something that at its heart is wasteful, like, let's just be frank, like, it's wasteful. Like, I'm in a wasteful industry. I understand that. Like, how do we make this waste meaningful? Right. Like, at the end of the day, you don't need a book in your house. You don't. But if you are going to have a book in your house, it's a book that's worth having in your house.
All right. Tell me about Soil, the book that's the first of this Advanced Readers Club and the one that kind of got you thinking about stuff in a real practical way. We're going to do something different about it.
What I will say is that I am appreciative of the fact that, like, this happens to be the book that launches it, because this is a book by a woman who is, and I told her this, like, on some, like, how dare you believe this? The audacity of it's like, this is going to get this woman a MacArthur. This book is literally extending a canon about the relationship between Black Americans specifically and Black people in the diaspora at large to reconcile with their relationship with land, right? Like, nature as a grand scheme of things has historically been seen in the West as the sort of like eminent domain of white men, right? So much so that, like, nature writing is, when you think of, not, you know, maybe not you per se,
I got you,
but when I think, when someone says, oh, a nature, you seldom see people. One, period. Like, we're not even talking white, black. Like, you just sell, you see trees, you see birds, you see animals, insects, but you don't think of people as natural, which is already part of why we have the kind of environmental disaster is like when we conceive of ourselves as being other than the world than which we inhabit, it makes sense why we would want to destroy this world. Because we're already coming at it from this sort of like man versus world. Oh, we have to conquer this because we're not of it. So if you see yourself as being part of the natural order of things, you relate to nature differently. Now, specifically for people who have been, because of enslavement, because of the diaspora, because of urbanization, all these different things, then don't see themselves as having claim to nature, you have a double injury of one, not seeing humans as being a part of it, but then not seeing yourself as being in it, which means it then feels unnatural for you to be in this world. And you keep, and then out of that, you create these narratives of like, why is it necessary for people to say things that are seemingly basic, like a Black Life Matters, is because it's like any life that's quote unquote other is not seen as being indicative of what the world functions as its default, right? And then like what the default is like, you don't question a tree's growth. Mm-hmm. You understand? Like, it's like, oh, like that tree shouldn't grow. It's like, no, a tree should grow. But when it's like a person's in your neighborhood, it's like, why is that person here? It's like, why shouldn't that person be here? Right? Like, if anything, is like there's a certain sense of unnaturalness about how we've created these ways that people don't belong. So like in the grand scheme of things, is like that what this woman is bringing, what Camille is bringing with this book, is really like a really tangible way of thinking about the environment, but like linking it. Like one of the first stories in there is like about the day that she orders soil to arrive, and she ordered it without consulting her husband, not like on some like I need to get permission, but like
logistical this is level. The first, yeah.
Like on a logistical level,
yeah,
like
yeah.
I did not organize this with anybody else, and all this soil arrived on the windiest day of the season, and my husband is about to go to work. And if, because of my selfish decision, this soil could get blown away because I didn't do the work of like making mm-hmm. sure that I got the community involved in what I'm doing, right? Like that's what that first chapter sets up. And that was not the original first chapter. That came forth. But because of revision, I was like, that notion has to be put up front, right? And she was talking about, like, there's in that chapter, I see you've read it, she talks about the white poets who only read their own poems. And like,
yeah.
And before that, I was like, but Camille, do you not see how you're kind of doing, working from right. the same kind of framework that these poets are functioning from? And part of what was heartening about that opening was because it was her taking accountability for the ways that her aspirations to be seen as a part of this canon came at a price to the people around her. Like, who pays for our desires to be seen as these kinds of figures in nature? Like, what's the price of that?
Yeah.
Right? Like, you know, so it was like a way to first dispel, like, damn, like, in order for me to even write this book, I got to first show how I was complicit with this aspiration of like, no, I wanted to be a nature writer. And what did that mean? That I was willing to just disregard anybody else's
yeah, perform nature, concern. Perform gardening on
yeah,
my own.
Yeah. yeah and this performative gardening almost yeah. meant that my soil wasn't even, I wasn't even able to build the thing without the community. It's like nobody gets what they get without community. And that's why, like, one of the things I've, even in this conversation, I've been really cautious of is like when I say like, oh, I'm edit, no, it's like a book that I'm responsible for. Like when I'm on the page, it's like that's the extent to which it's individual, but I don't acquire a book by myself. It's not like a person yeah. that submits a book and like, I'll give you this much money, I gotta run it through all these people. And that's not a detriment to the, that's not a bug of the job, that's the feature of it.
Yeah,
you have all these people collaborating on bringing something to life. What better book
yeah.
to exemplify the collaborative communal nature of publishing than a book that's really showing that community and collaboration should be, we should regard those things as natural.
I think that's a good place to end. God damn it. We could go for two more hours. I've got so many questions for you, man. Do I appreciate your time and your honesty and likewise. Candor. This was amazing.
All right.
I appreciate looking it. Forward. Take care.
Likewise. Talk cheers. To you.
Today's episode is brought to you by WW Norton & Company Incorporated. So, Negative Space by Gillian Linden follows a week in the life of an English teacher at a New York private school. At home, her children ask constant questions about mortality, and her husband offers occasional counsel between Zoom calls. At school, something happens. She accidentally witnesses an ambiguous, possibly inappropriate interaction between a teacher and a student, but how can she be sure of what she saw? Negative Space is a portrait of a woman caught between the pressures of what's normal and what isn't, and examines what we owe the people who depend on us in a fractured and indifferent world. It's a debut novel and a short novel. It's perfect if you want something quick and easy to carry around, but it's also thought-provoking. It takes place during the pandemic, but it's not pandemic-focused, and it really just looks at everyday anxieties in low-threat situations that have high consequences. So make sure to check out Negative Space by Gillian Linden. And thanks again to W.W. Norton & Company Incorporated for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
Coming up next, Sarah Bakewell, the author of many books on philosophy and the humanities that are popular, that people read and bought. I bought them. I read them. So did my dad. Her new book is called Humanly Possible, and it's about the broad sweep of humanism over several centuries, who the humanists were, what they believed, what they fought about, where we are now. I first encountered her with her book on Michel de Montaigne called How to Live, and I really liked it. I've been a Michel de Montaigne fan for a long, long time. 16th century philosopher, writer, generally considered the creator of what we now know as the essay, who inherited some money, minor French nobility, but used all that clout to basically hole up for as much of his life as he could, writing and reading. Unbelievably influential to me as a 15-year-old, kind of embarrassing, but I'm not ashamed here. Also would have been a fantastic podcaster. So we start off talking about Montaigne, but in general, we move on to the rest of the book. Really excited to have her, so stick around for that after the break. This is Sarah Bakewell, so we're going to talk about humanism and her new book, Humanly Possible. How did you come to do this book next? What was the hook that came from the Montaigne and other things that you've done to get into this book directly?
There was definitely a connection. I was interested to explore the connections between different aspects of humanism that I discovered I'd already been writing about and thinking about for some time without particularly labeling it as that. Mm-hmm. But Montaigne is certainly a huge connection there. Seeing him as a humanist, it's like I'd written about all sorts of aspects of what he was doing. That was one of them, but I hadn't been particularly focused on that one. And it really struck me that he is pivotal in the story because he's someone who was writing within the humanist literary classical tradition and referring to all these great classical authors that he loved and to the humanist training that he himself had through childhood, but he was also rebelling against it, mm-hmm. Rejecting it, being quite irreverent about it, saying things like, Cicero is nothing but hot air, whereas that was, all the humanists adored Cicero, and you don't say that sort of thing. But adding into the mix was also the fact that I have really always been a humanist in the definition that tends to be predominant now, at least in the English-speaking world, which is someone who lives a life that where the sense of meaning and the kind of moral sense come from sources that are not connected to religion of any kind, not connected to religious dogma. And I started to think, God, there's actually so many things that I've always been interested in that all touch on the theme of humanism, but it's different kinds of humanism maybe. And I wanted to find out more about that. And I wanted to explore those connections in particular that link all those things together.
It definitely feels like, I think you can tell me if I'm wrong, but the way the book is structured represents that sense of exploration, right? It's not sort of Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy, where there's a chapter about this school of thought, followed by this school of thought, followed by this school of thought. You proceed sort of orderly through time, but you're not, you know, restricting yourself in that chapter that time. It's because even the chapter headings feel like a, you know, an older model where it's, you know, a dash and then here's one thing that's going to be in this chapter and a dash.
Yeah,
so delightful.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah, like a miscellany kind of element to it.
Well, yeah, I exactly. I mean, I wanted to, part of the reason even for those, that style of chapter subheading was that I wanted it to feel a bit playful and explorative. And also I wanted to make clear that it's not a comprehensive history of humanism. It's not a encyclopedia of humanism. I mean, that would be, I haven't got enough lifetimes available to achieve.
Well, you
that.
Tell stories about people trying to write encyclopedias and giving up after two volumes or getting thrown into prison, or, you know, it doesn't go well for people writing encyclopedias in your book, I'm
exactly.
afraid.
Yeah, that's right. And I, you know, I didn't want to get caught up in that. But also I just thought I don't have the expertise to write about the entire history of humanism. And also, I was very aware that almost entirely, apart from a, you know, a few things here and there, but it really is very much a story of the European humanist tradition. With, of course, there are some Americans that feature very prominently in it, and there's a few other people from other parts of the world, but it is absolutely overwhelmingly predominantly, you know, this is a book about the European humanist tradition. And that is, I don't want to say limitation, but it is a limitation. I mean, that's what I was writing about because, again, I wanted to keep some connection between the people. So although it covers 700 years, a lot of these people they had read each other's work. They were responding to it. They were, you know, trying to move in a different direction or advance what had been done before or react against what had been done before sometimes. And so I wanted to keep some kind of boundary around it so that there's a bit of continuity in how they responded to each other and the fact that they read each other's work. It is it kind of an exploration. It's kind of playful in that I was myself discovering, and I've really done this with all of my books, I was discovering it as I went along.
I think that, again, it's so opposite of how you're taught in school about intellectual history, which, you know, it's usually a history of isms or Idics or something like that, and the people are part of it, but they're in service to the noun or the school of thought from which they're now, you know, sort of retroactively ascribed, but then really focusing on individual humans doing the work of humanism at the same time. That makes it feel, I don't know, alive in a way that I think it makes it especially fun, because these seems like you create characters and follow their personalities and their foibles. I think makes it extremely readable and fun, and because it can feel moldy in a way. These are old texts, they're centuries old, and it really comes alive here. It struck me reading it again that you come at it as a late comer to history, right? Where the rise of a certain humanistic inquiry is baked into the pie by this, especially after World War II, where most of us who are, you know, thinking and reading and being educated happen. Forget or didn't know, or it was underplayed, how contested humanism was all along. So many of these authors had their books banned, burned, they were imprisoned, they were killed, they were hounded. You know, Thomas Mann sending his kids to go get his manuscripts out of his house. E.M. Forster putting the manuscript for Maurice in his drawer because he's afraid of publishing it. And this is a story that continues.
A lot depends on what kind of humanism. There are many humanists around the world whose lives are in danger. I'm sure Humanists International probably is the source of this, that there's really 80 countries or so around the world where it's dangerous to some degree to speak openly about being a humanist or questioning the religious orthodoxy in various ways. There's, I think, 13, 14 countries where and run right up to the death penalty. So that I think is something never to forget about what the humanists of the past suffered and how they had to hide and conceal what they were doing and at what danger they were sometimes in, which they were, that this story is not over. I mean, I very much tell a story in the book of the humanism always accompanied by a parallel story of what I kind of just for convenience call anti-humanism. It is like a shadow story that goes alongside it. I don't believe in some sort of great, glorious victory for humanism.
It's all, we've figured it out. Everyone's fine. No, I mean, it's just going to be cool from here on out. What should we be working on, or what sticks in your mind as something that is a frontier of humanism still?
I think one aspect of humanism that is often not well understood by people who, and a lot of people don't know very much about humanism, including some humanists. I mean, I went along not knowing that I was a humanist for a very long time. That's quite a common experience, I think. Then you come across it and you think, oh, so I'm a humanist too. Yeah, right. That explains it. But one of the things that I think is really not well understood about humanism is how it differs from, say, the kind of purely a matter of skepticism or radical atheism. Right. Humanism is more positive. Humanism is about positive values. And I think that's where the difference is. And specifically, one of the features of humanism that I think is not well known is that it really stresses our connection with other people and also with the rest of the natural world. So it's not exclusively, it's not some kind of anthropocentrism, which is, you know, disrespectful to the rest of the life forms on this earth. So those are two things. One is that's not well understood. And the other thing is that this sense of, if there is going to be a foundation for morality, which is not that of the institutional religions and doesn't depend on any supernatural belief, then it probably is to be found in our connection with other people and connection with those around us and the shared sense of community and the shared humanity, the basic recognition of each other's humanity that seems to for the most part to come quite naturally to us. I mean, we're social creatures. A lot of humanists will look for the heart of ethical life and moral life and also our sense of meaning as emerging from that connection. There's a famous line which I think captures that very well, which is often quoted by humanists. I am human and nothing human is alien to me. I consider nothing human alien to me. It comes from the Roman playwright Terence in the first century AD. And it's funny because in the play that it appears in, it's actually a joke, really, because there's this guy who is nosy about what all his neighbors are getting up to. And somebody else says to him, you know, why can't you mind your own business? Why are you always peering over your neighbor's fence? And he says, as a wisecrack, really, he says, as a gag, he says, what can I do? You know, I'm human. Everything human is of interest to me. So it's a joke. And then it goes actually on to become one of the deepest philosophical statements of humanism, which I think is quite funny. You know, these things do change their relevance over time.
There's an Arthur C. Clarke novel that you talk about as being meaningful to you both as an early reader, but also that you've come back later and reconsiders as a humanist or as a humanist problem or document. So what was it about that Arthur C. Clarke novel that got you so interested and continues to, you know, be generative for you?
I've always been a keen reader of science fiction. This is one, it's called Childhood's End, and it tells of a future. It imagines a future in which humans are ticking along and suddenly these aliens arrive. But the first thing they do is give us lots of wonderful things. And there's this great line, actually, where they lay on all these TV channels and there's so much that you can watch. I think it's something like 50 hours a day of TV. They sort of just make us very comfortable, but they quietly phase out, you know, humans as they are. And with coming generations, new humans are born, which have a connection to the overmind, as it's called. And then even more generations come along and they just really cease to be physical beings at all. You get these generations of people that just stand around in the fields and eventually they just sort of melt upwards, and all of physical reality on this planet is absorbed upwards into this giant, transcendent, shared, universal mind.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite mind-blowing, literally, really. It's
mind-sucking up, mind-teleporting,
I mean, it's transcendent. It's a mystical, transcendent conception of becoming one with the universe. But it's also the idea of becoming of a higher level of being. So somehow transcending the merely human everyday, what we have now. And it's an exciting thing to sort of imagine. But on the other hand, when I read it now, and this is the point I make in the book, when I tell that story right at the end of the book, is that now I tend to think about what's lost in all of that. And what has emerged from that is no longer recognizably human at all, because how can anything be human anymore if it doesn't have a body and mortality and all the details of our lives, all the details of the planet that we occupy and of our culture and our relationships and all the nitty gritty of being human, which is all somehow just, it's all gone upwards into this, you know, transcendent realm. The interesting thing is that a lot of mystical visions in religion also have the same structure, really. They show some future state, which is one of perfection and fulfillment, for which the, and of course not all religion does this, I'm not saying that it does at all, but there is this strand that says present reality doesn't count for much. It's messy and it might be a world of sin, and that we really need to transcend that. We need to redeem it. But the more humanist tradition would say, well, maybe yes, maybe no, whatever, we don't know. But the point is that, you know, we are here now. This is the world that we live in. This is where all our meaning comes from on an everyday basis. There's a line from a 19th century American speaker and writer on general humanism and free thought called Robert G. Ingersoll. He came up with what he called the happiness creed, which is four lines long, really. It's happiness is the only good. The time to be happy is now. The place to be happy is here. The way to be happy is to make others so. And that last line is crucial, of course, because it's not just a selfish pursuit of happiness.
And become recursive, right? It feeds back into the
process. But it also implies that, you know, for it to be real happiness, it can't be just a selfish, immediate, you know, seeking of your own personal gratification. It's about our connection with other people. So it brings us back to that idea of the importance of connection again.
That's it for the show. We're going to be back in 2 weeks on April 19th. Check us out then. Thanks to Yidan Israel, Sarah Bakewell, Rebecca Shinsky. Thanks to you. You can email me at firstedition@bookriot.com. Check the show notes to links to Instagram, Twitter, Substack. Really appreciate your time. Had a great time. Can't wait for the next one. Until then, read something great.